Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. A weekend break in the criminal hush money trial of former President Trump after Hope Hicks, once Trump's most trusted advisor, or one of them, took the witness stand. Legal journalist Christian Farias.
As soon as she took the stand on cross, she broke down. Just the fact that she was technically and in reality testifying against her former boss and someone who basically launched her career, it must have meant something extremely significant for her.
Hicks testifying Friday that she believed Trump preferred to have allegations of an affair with Stormy Daniels come out after the 2016 election, supporting the prosecution's theory that killing the story was meant to help his campaign. Mexican authorities say three bodies have been recovered from an area of Baja California near where two Australians and an American went missing last weekend. Brown, Northwestern, and Rutgers, among a small number of universities reaching agreements with pro-Palestinian student protesters to end encampments. This is ABC News. The Federal Trade Commission is warning about a new wave of job scams hitting college grads right about now as they're looking for their first full-time jobs. The FTC's Assistant Director of the Division of Marketing Practices, Katie Daffin, lays out the fake job scam.
I'm your new employer. You need to buy office equipment to get started with your job, and I'm going to reimburse you when I send you your first check. What you don't know is you pay for the office equipment. You never get the office equipment. You're out the money. And then at the end of the day, you never do get a first paycheck.
So Daffin's advice?
If people are asking you to pay money for anything, that's a red flag.
More than 6 months after that horrific mass shooting in Lewiston, Maine, the bowling alley where the first shots were fired has now reopened. The just-in-time bowling alley welcoming back guests after undergoing a complete makeover. The names of the eight victims who were killed there in October and the 10 more killed at a nearby bar displayed on 18 bowling pins. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Most of us agree that every Wisconsinite deserves affordable health care. California mega millionaire Eric Hovde does not. Hovde said he would repeal the Affordable Care Act, quote, in its entirety. What? The Affordable Care Act protects people from insurance companies refusing coverage for pre-existing conditions and stops them from dropping your coverage if you get sick. If Eric Hovde got his way, millions of Americans could get hit with increases in their healthcare premiums of 20% or more. Millions more could lose coverage altogether. Hovde even spoke out against parents helping their kids by keeping them on their health insurance plans until they turn 26. Now that might be okay for Eric Hovde. His businesses have raked in millions of dollars in handouts. But it doesn't cut it for hardworking Wisconsinites and our families. Call Eric Hovde at his California office, 714-730-4444. Tell him we support lower health care costs. Paid for by Better Wisconsin Together Incorporated.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. May Day is an important day for the labor movement. This year, worker advocates are calling for fixing systemic problems with Social Security. Here's Mike Mohn.
The American Federation of Government Employees is co-leading demonstrations around the state, with attendees calling on Congress to fully fund a Social Security. President for Council 220, Jessica LaPointe, says the problems run deep right now, with chronic underfunding resulting in staffing woes at field offices. Not only are staffers dealing with added stress, but beneficiaries also are feeling the impact.
Service delays are far and wide, and it could take, you know, more than 4 months to start your retirement benefits up.
Beyond helping with administrative costs, demonstrators want federal lawmakers to come up with long-term funding solutions amid predictions the program won't be able to provide full benefits a decade from now. Some Republicans have routinely floated cuts, but advocates say any future shortfalls should be covered by higher earners. Supporters of that idea recommend adjusting the cap on Social Security taxes. The Wisconsin Alliance for Retired Americans is also out at these rallies, and Executive Director Alex Brower says retirees on fixed incomes deserve full and expanded benefits for dedicating their working lives to propping up the economy.
We wouldn't have any of the systems in our economy without working people, and so when those working people retire, we are demanding that that retirement be dignified.
He says May Day observances, which often center around worker solidarity, are a good way to tell policymakers that the working class shouldn't fall into poverty when they retire. Similar rallies are scheduled throughout the month. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm Corey Hartman with your forecast for today. Showers and thunderstorms. We'll see highs in the upper 50s. For tonight, mostly clear, lows around 40. Sunshine for Sunday, highs near 67. Mostly clear Sunday night, a low of 44. Mostly sunny and breezy for Monday with a high near 73.
It's 45 degrees right now.
Earl Ingram.
Monday morning, join me as I stroll through memory lane and take in the sounds of the Motor City. It's Motown Mondays.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 till 10.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, and I am your host for, yes, this second hour of our weekend broadcast. This is our weekly weekend assessment, a review, our analysis of things like government actions and legal principles, and yes, indeed, the aspiration for justice in our nation and beyond. Thank you so much for joining me for this, our second hour. As always, we are taking your phone calls as well at 844-967-2789. You can also get into our program and engage in our discussions through the Civic Media app. Again, 844-967-2789. My wonderful producer, Kelvin, and I here ready to take your inquiries, your questions about the many different areas on our syllabus this weekend. Thank you. Thank you for once again joining us for this discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review. We are talking, as we always do, about the United States Supreme Court. They issue opinions at this time of year that have dramatically changed and sometimes not changed the very geography of our nation. Appropriate to understand that of the 62 cases on the docket of the Supreme Court in this, its 2023-2024 term, 62 cases the Supreme Court has decided it will review. It has already issued opinions in 18 of those. 18 of those cases already the subject of its opinions. And so, for example, we have talked on this broadcast about a recent decision of the Supreme Court in a case called Muldrow versus City of St. Louis, a unanimous decision. Keep that in mind, an important aspect of this. All nine justices determining in the end that workers can indeed pursue employment discrimination claims over job transfers, movements inside their employment, without having to show that an involuntary move with which they disagreed caused some significant disadvantage, like harm to career prospects or a change in salary or rank. What that means is, again, that under Title VII, the options for showing employment discrimination in the terms and conditions of employment are broader, or at least now that they are defined under Muldrow versus City of St. Louis, according to all the members, all of them, all nine of them unanimously agreed to this broader understanding of the circumstances under which employment discrimination claims can be made. We know as well that nine of the justices, all of them unanimously, in a case called O'Connor-Ratcliffe versus Garnier and Linkey versus Freed, actually two cases brought together, they said this about social media, focus a lot on social media, this docket. Public officials, they said, can be liable for blocking or deleting their critics from their social media accounts, but only when they're acting in an official capacity and with actual authority from the government for which they work to speak on behalf of that government. In this pair of unanimous decisions, again, the court said that public officials are still private citizens with their own constitutional rights, but if information is accessible only on those personal accounts and a public official blocks a critic, prevents them from getting access to it, that's when rights to constitutional access to information can, in fact, be unconstitutional. A significant case again, O'Connor Ratcliffe and Linke versus Freed, that also decided. And a third case I'll highlight again this weekend, also unanimous, which again is a part of the appropriate identification of what's going on here. We're getting a lot of cases where they all agree. So those are coming out now. A case, of course, as you know, ballot eligibility for Donald Trump. Colorado cannot disqualify Donald Trump, could not disqualify Donald Trump because of his actions before and during the January 6th attack. And that decision issued way back in March. Justice said that the Constitution does not permit a single state to bar a presidential candidate from national office. And they declared instead that the responsibility rests exclusively with the Congress and not the states, keeping Donald Trump on the docket there in Colorado and across the United States of America. Other states also looking to that. So three cases among the 14 highlighting this weekend here on our broadcast, but many others undecided. We'll give you some sampling this weekend and in the weekends ahead of what we're still anticipating from the Supreme Court. It is going to be a busy time. This is the time, mid-May. Into mid-June, approximately, when the Supreme Court starts to issue some of the decisions. We have talked already again on this weekend broadcast about this case, Trump versus United States, the immunity case. That will be coming out highly, highly unlikely, depending upon what they decide, that will be a unanimous decision. It appears that six members of our Supreme Court may be going in the direction of identifying this bifurcated analysis where there are some areas where if they're official conduct, if there is official acts, that those might be protected by some concept of immunity. But if they're personal, those are not. A distinction, again, that I and many others who look at this from not only a legal perspective, but also a broad constitutional and republic, future of the republic position, view as ridiculous, as a position that cannot be embraced. We will see what the Supreme Court does. That one, very highly controversial. Argued just on April 25th. We know as well there's another case that we have talked about on this broadcast, Fisher versus United States. Doesn't involve Donald Trump by name, but plainly implicates once again this prosecution pending against him right now in the federal district court in the District of Columbia, alleging election interference, four counts there brought by a federal indictment. That case suspended while the Supreme Court determines whether or not there is immunity in that other case. And also, arguably, depending upon what they do in Fisher, that could also have an impact upon not only the prosecutions, the convictions of hundreds of people that have been prosecuted and sentenced and in many cases incarcerated under a particular statute. And the question there in Fisher is whether prosecutors properly charged them and arguably, derivatively, whether the grand jury in the Trump case properly charged Donald Trump using a law that makes it a crime to obstruct or impede an official proceeding. In this case, the disruption of Congress's certification of the 2020 election results. We know that well from what we saw on January 6th. The question is whether or not the statute applies. That's Fisher. That was argued on April 16th. We will see what the Supreme Court does. It appears there from the tea leaves that a majority of the Supreme Court, as we have said previously, the majority of the Supreme Court in the Fisher case appears inclined to say that the application of Section 1512, which is the statute under which Mr. Fisher and others, and yes, indeed, Donald Trump has also been prosecuted, is not applicable, at least to on-the-ground activities. Question whether or not the statute is applicable to the charges against Donald Trump in the other discrete case against him. That will be the subject of even more litigation, depending upon what the Supreme Court says. The third major case coming out of the Supreme Court having to do with Donald Trump. Other things we're also anticipating in the area of guns as well. Guns for suspected domestic abusers. This is the Rahimi case, United States versus Rahimi. An argument held way back on November 7th. The question there, the big gun case on the docket of the Supreme Court this term, whether a law, a federal law, disarming individuals who are subject to domestic violence protective orders issued by state courts, whether that violates the Second Amendment. There is a federal law that prohibits anyone, again, under the Second Amendment, one of those situations where the Second Amendment, not unconditional, has restrictions on it. A federal law that has been upheld up to this point that says if you are subject to a domestic violence restraining order, you cannot possess a weapon. You can't hold one. You can't use one. You can't sell one or transfer one. And Mr. Rahimi, challenging that in this case, argued before the Supreme Court back in November, questioned whether or not the Supreme Court will uphold that federal law in one of its major guns cases. And it appears that they are poised, that is the nine members of the Supreme Court, poised probably to allow that ban to remain in place. This is a bridge too far, especially with the facts from Mr. Rahimi and his particular conduct. We'll see what the Supreme Court does in the Rahimi case having to do with the intersection between federal law and this domestic violence restraining order situation. Another big case we're still waiting for a decision on. This is called Garland. Yes, that's our Attorney General. Garland versus Cargill. This is the bump stock ban. The bump stock ban. You call this case is whether a federal ban on bump stocks, that is when attached to rifles, these devices, as you know well, speed up how quickly bullets can be fired from a firearm, whether that's permitted under federal law. And the question is whether or not bump stocks are firearms. And the fact that they're attached to firearms to increase the velocity to how quickly these bullets can be fired, whether that renders them subject to review, analysis, and regulation by the ATF and the federal government generally. A federal ban on bump stocks implemented by the Trump administration continued under the Biden administration. We all recall well the Las Vegas gunman, 2017, killing dozens of people, the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history there in Las Vegas. That was a bump stock case, and that's what prompted the regulation now being challenged in the Supreme Court, determined sometime in Garland versus Cargill whether or not bump stocks are illegal in the United States or whether the prohibition on them violates the Second Amendment. Then we've got all sorts of abortion cases, which is also going to lead us to our discussion this weekend about what's happened in two of our states. We've got this case called FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. Remember this case? Argument not too long ago, March 26. The question there, whether to restrict access to this key abortion medication used predominantly in the United States along with a secondary pharmaceutical. It's called mifepristone. It's used in more than half of all U.S. abortions and was first approved by the FDA way back in 2000. Abortion medication, of course, has increased in importance as more than a dozen states have restricted or banned abortion since the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. That number approaching even 20 now these days in the wake of the Supreme Court decision in Dobbs. This question of mifepristone, much related to the Dobbs decision. And the question is whether or not the FDA decision to permit that drug to be in the public domain, the authorization by the FDA back in 2000, tested and analyzed ever since then, in the quarter century since then, whether the FDA should be second-guessed. It appears that the courts seemed unlikely to restrict the access to that drug, mifepristone, but we will also be taking a look at that as well. More of this analysis, a brief review of what the Supreme Court has in its docket coming up as we continue here on our weekend broadcast, Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
I'm Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I learned about atrial fibrillation the hard way. My symptoms would come and go, shortness of breath, fatigue. I kept going. Then I got so lightheaded, I couldn't. My doctor said I have AFib, so I'm about five times more likely to have a stroke. Other symptoms, irregular heartbeat, heart racing, chest pain can come and go, but the risk of stroke stays. If you have symptoms, tell a doctor. Visit notimetowait.com.
Sponsored by Bristol-Myers Squibb and Pfizer.
Here's a fun fact for you.
The average chameleon can point their eyes in two different directions. On the other hand, the average human can't. So unless you're a chameleon, there's absolutely no way you can focus on texting and driving at the same time. So don't do it, unless you're a chameleon.
Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
This is Amicus, a Law Review, and we are talking in this segment of our weekend broadcast about what we can anticipate from the United States Supreme Court in the weeks just ahead. Yes, the next 5, 6, maybe 7 weeks out there, going to be populated by lots and lots of decisions in many different areas of our lives and livelihoods, as the Supreme Court has done virtually every year in our contemporary lives, deciding major cases. This is the time period. Early, mid, late May, into June especially. Early June, especially a hot period of time for the Supreme Court to begin to issue these decisions, including as we were talking, about cases involving reproductive rights, privacy rights under the Constitution, all of that, in the wake of the decision almost 2 years ago now, June of 2022, and a decision issued by the majority, not a unanimous verdict, not a unanimous judgment by the Supreme Court, but by an opinion written by Sam Alito, finding that the privacy rights, to the extent that they adhere at all in the Constitution, do not extend to abortion rights, to reproductive rights. That, of course, is the Dobbs decision that has changed dramatically what is happening in America with respect to abortion rights and access. We talked already about this major case, FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, determining in the wake of that decision whether or not the drug mifepristone, in the wake of Dobbs, and it's no longer finding this position of privacy rights in the Constitution for abortion, whether the FDA's decision to authorize that drug as reasonably safe and secure, whether that should continue, likely that the Supreme Court will afford the FDA the discretion that it has exercised in finding that it is, for the most part, a safe and secure drug tested over a couple of decades and more, likely that mifepristone will be affirmed, if you will, in that sense, by the Supreme Court, overturning a lower appellate court and certainly a district court judge that found that mifepristone was not properly administered and overseen by the FDA. There is another case that's also pending in the area of privacy rights and reproductive rights, abortion rights, and that's Idaho versus United States. We've talked about this on our weekend broadcast as well. Oral argument held just recently, April 24th. The case, once again, Idaho versus United States. The question there, whether a federal law requiring emergency room care for life-threatening cases means that emergency room doctors in states across the country that have strict abortion bans must nonetheless terminate those pregnancies in certain circumstances. The Biden administration taking the view that this federal law requires that medical doctors in ER situations preserve the vitality and sustenance of women when their lives are being threatened and are obliged to perform those abortions to continue to address their health situations. In a situation like Idaho, in that particular state, it has passed a law, a state law, that prohibits abortion entirely. And the question is, which one of those holds? The Supreme Court, again, hearing argument on this case on April 24th, determining, again, whether or not the federal law will be supreme over the state law. The assumption is that the federal law, pursuant to the Supremacy Clause, will hold, and that the interpretation given that law by the Biden administration will indeed supersede, if you will, the state law in Idaho that prohibits abortions entirely. Very significant abortion case pending there in the Supreme Court. having to do with the intersection between state law and federal law when it comes to abortion. Many other cases also pending in future broadcasts of this program. We will talk about those other things as they're coming up. And certainly we will also discuss the cases as they are decided by the Supreme Court. We are talking, therefore, about the cases before the Supreme Court having to do with abortion. And indeed, because of the wake of the decision in the Dobbs case, we know that a lot of the decision-making has gone on now in the states. You know a lot about that. There's been happening for 2 years, ever since the Supreme Court decided that Dobbs case in June of 2022, focusing this weekend on Amicus Law Review on two states in particular. Lots of activity just this past week in the states of Arizona and also Florida. Arizona lawmakers just this past Wednesday repealed an abortion ban that first became law when Abraham Lincoln was president and a half century before women won the right to vote. Now, where do we get to that? How do we get to that point in Arizona where this major thing happened? And what are the implications? What does this look like going ahead? Well, a recent Supreme Court decision there in the state of Arizona. This is the state Supreme Court, not the federal Supreme Court. Ruling by 4-2, they upheld the 1864 law that prohibited virtually all abortion procedures. They said physicians are now on notice that all abortions except those necessary to save a woman's life are illegal. Now, needless to say, that prompted a lot of reaction on all sides of the political aisle when it comes to this hotbed issue of abortion and privacy rights, not just in Arizona, but also across the country. The state attorney general there said she's going to decline criminal prosecutions of doctors and others, describing the ruling of the Supreme Court as unconscionable and an affront to freedom. On the other side of the docket, you have a group called the Alliance Defending Freedom saying, we celebrate now the decision that allows the state's pro-life law to again protect the lives of countless innocent unborn children. So what happens? Well, in the wake of that, putting this 1864 law back into place or simply affirming its applicability there in Arizona by a 16-14 vote, the state Senate just this past week, with the support of every Democratic senator and, yes, two Republicans, this is a bipartisan 16-14 vote, repealed that 19th century law. And the governor, her name is Katie Hobbs there in Arizona, she signed that bill. And as a result of that, the state will now be governed by a 2022 law, another law that was passed obviously long after the 1864 law, but following Dobbs, that prohibits abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Interestingly and concerningly, no rape or incest exceptions in that law. So the 2022 law now becomes the state law in Arizona almost. And why do I say that? Well, the repeal of the 1864 law by virtue of Arizona law does not become effective until 90 days after the legislature adjourns. It has repealed the 1864 law, but the repeal of that doesn't become effective for 90 more days, which means that more than technically right now, the 1864 law remains in place. It will go out of applicability effectiveness 90 days after they leave and the 2022 law goes into effect. We will talk more about all of that and also talk about the state of Florida here on Amicus, a Law Review.
Air 1260 AM WLAK.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. A weekend break in the criminal hush money trial of former President Trump after Hope Hicks, once Trump's most trusted advisor, or one of them, took the witness stand, legal journalist Christian Furious.
As soon as she took the stand on cross, she broke down. Just the fact that she was technically and in reality testifying against her former boss and someone who basically launched her career, it must have meant something extremely significant for her.
Hicks testifying Friday that she believed Trump preferred to have allegations of an affair with Stormy Daniels come out after the 2016 election, supporting the prosecution's theory that killing the story was meant to help his campaign. Mexican authorities say three bodies have been recovered from an area of Baja California near where two Australians and an American went missing last weekend. Brown, Northwestern, and Rutgers, among a small number of universities reaching agreements with pro-Palestinian student protesters to end encampments. This is ABC News.
Brewers beat the Cubs. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Wrigley Field, the Cubs and Brewers, and Milwaukee comes out on top with a 3-1 win. Joe Ross, the winning pitcher, the crew laying down bunts, stealing bases, moving base runners, manager Pat Murphy suspended. So Ricky Weeks taking over was asked, were those his decisions?
Have you seen his play yet? And that's what we do. For our offense to really work, I think we got to be creative. And creativity comes with getting on base, maybe having a little bunt here or two, still a base here or there, but those guys in that clubhouse there, those are baseball players. So when you have that, you got a good chance of winning a baseball game at the end.
NFL Packers rookie minicamp underway in Green Bay. Last year, Alex Magoo was the number 3 starting quarterback. Today, he's listed as a wide receiver.
He spent a lot of time on the practice squad or on the scout team running receiver routes. So we felt like that might be his best chance here.
That's Packers head coach Matt LaFleur. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm Corey Hartman with your forecast for today. Showers and thunderstorms. We'll see highs in the upper 50s. For tonight, mostly clear, lows around 40. Sunshine for Sunday, highs near 67. Mostly clear Sunday night, a low of 44. Mostly sunny and breezy for Monday with a high near 73.
It's 45 degrees right now.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matt and Air on Air with Jane Matt and Air. Weekdays 10 till noon on Lake Air 107.5 FM and 1260 AM WLAK. And on the Civic Media app. The Todd Alba Show.
State Senator Kelda Royce in Richland County. The UW system made the unilateral decision to completely vacate the campus by July 1st of this year.
It's so short-sighted to think it costs a little bit more money to run it and there aren't as many students, so let's just shut it down. A smart business owner would say now is the time to invest because we know every person that comes through the door, you're going to get 40-fold the investment from how they're going to be able to give back to our state.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Earl Ingram.
In Wisconsin, parents pay one-third of their income on child care. Think about what we need our income for. Shelter, food, clothing, gas bill, electric bill. And we're talking about one child. This is a crisis. Young families are saddled with what is almost impossible to deal with.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Are you prepared for an emergency or disaster? Because it's not a matter of if, but when. Don't find yourself saying,
when the storm rolls in, my time to find a pet-friendly evacuation center will have run out.
The scorching heat wave will leave me powerless to cool my insulin.
I'll face a hurricane without meds. Now that's a tough pill to swallow.
Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell. Get started at ready.gov/olderadults. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
It's producer Amanda. On the next Mino and the Mayor, the guys are joined by Frank Hermans, who has a new show at the Meyer. And the folks from Caribbean Taste Food Truck in Appleton are in our small business spotlight.
Mino and the Mayor, weekday mornings 6 till 9.
The This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for these remaining segments on our weekend review of now talking about abortion in America, talking specifically about major events in two states, in Arizona, and yes, in just a moment or so, Florida, things that happened in the wake of the 2022 decision by the Supreme Court saying that there no longer is, if ever there was, a position inside, vested inside the Supreme Court that establishes a privacy right to reproductive rights and abortion. Talking about the situation in Arizona, where just this past week, the governor signed legislation repealing this 19th century law that imposed a prohibition on virtually all abortion procedures, effectively now going into effect 90 days after the legislature leaves and moves on to other things. And also in the meantime, effectively keeping that 1864 law in place. All of that sort of confusing procedural history, prompting an awful lot of people to say we need to do something even in the interim to ensure that the 1864 law does not take place in that state. But the governor, of course, the attorney general has said they will pursue no prosecutions of anyone under that 1864 law. But the 2022 law is also getting a lot of attention because it, too, prohibits abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy with no exceptions for rape or incest. Look to Arizona for a lot more action there. Indeed, State Senator Anna Hernandez, who is one of the sponsors of the repeal measure, said, "We are standing in a moment of Arizona history." Certainly that is the case for Arizona as they wrestle with the 1864 law, the 2022 law, and the interplay between a state Supreme Court, legislative action, executive action on this issue. More certainly coming out from the state of Arizona, coming out also from the state of Florida, where once again we have action initiated by a state Supreme Court. This once again is not the federal Supreme Court. It's the state Supreme Court in Florida. A recent Supreme Court decision, this one is 6-1, says that based upon our analysis, finding no clear right to abortion embodied in the privacy clause of the state constitution, the petitioner here cannot overcome the presumption of constitutionality. And therefore, basically keeping in place a Florida ban after six weeks of pregnancy passed by the legislature. Interestingly, in a separate ruling on the same day, same Supreme Court said, even though we're going to find that that ban, that six-week pregnancy ban, remains in place, by a separate ruling, by a 4-3 decision, a very much split decision, the state Supreme Court there said that a proposed constitutional amendment, a change in the Constitution of the state of Florida, that would guarantee the right to an abortion before viability. That's the language of the proposed constitutional amendment. Usually before viability means around 24 weeks or so. That's the state of the medical condition today. That will be on the ballot in November. And the Supreme Court says, yes, indeed, that can be on the statewide ballot come November. And so that 6 weeks ban on abortions, which is now effective, and it became effective as of May 1, just this past week, just this past Wednesday, the 6-week ban on abortion is now effective in Florida. And two things will happen. One is that in November, months from now, the people of the state of Florida will go to the polls and determine whether or not they want to override, to supersede that 6-week ban by passing what's called Constitutional Amendment 4. This is the amendment, once again, that allows abortions before viability. That would need more than 60% of the votes in that November polling. So that is coming up. But in the meantime, the 6-week ban remains in place in the state of Florida, prompting an awful lot of advocacy, as in Arizona there, about this constitutional amendment, again, that would establish guaranteeing the right to an abortion before viability, usually around 24 weeks, whether that will become the law and the constitutional standard in the state of Florida, superseding what the legislature previously did. An awful lot of advocacy. We have seen recently the governor there, his name is Ron DeSantis, advocating that the law remain exactly as it is. This was his proposal in the past. This is his legislation passed by the state assembly and the state senate. Nonetheless, he is advocating for the defeat of Constitutional Amendment 4. And you also have others, including our vice president, Kamala Harris, there just this past week, advocating that Constitutional Amendment 4 should be passed by 60% or more of the people of the state of Florida. All of that happening in the states of our country as this issue continues to percolate up undeniably, not just in our courts, not just in our legislature, not just in our executive branches, but yes, indeed, in polling places, this continues to be a major issue. And the Supreme Court, as we indicated earlier in this broadcast, has not gotten out from under the need to address abortion issues. They've got those two cases pending for decision sometime soon in our nation's history. All of that happening in our courts of America. We also spend some time on this broadcast talking about financial crimes and economic crimes and other things affecting the future of our nation. And we talk also about civil liability, things brought by private parties, brought by the government to enforce the civil law, including, yes, that's right, the antitrust laws of our nation. We have not previously focused much, if at all, upon this major case pending right now in the federal district court in the District of Columbia involving Google. It is the strongest challenge by the federal government to so-called big tech's power, and it's nearing its climax right now. Just this past week, closing arguments in the wake of a weeks-long trial, the United States of America, brought by the antitrust division of the United States Department of Justice against Google and others. On Thursday and continuing into Friday, lawyers for the Department of Justice, state attorneys general, and Google deliver their final arguments in this years-long case initiated many years ago. It's called the United States and Others versus Google. And the question, again, is whether this tech giant broke federal antitrust laws to maintain its online search dominance. Those arguments concluding now, a decision anticipated by the district court. This case tried, a civil case tried in front of Amit Mehta. We have talked about him because he has been presiding over other cases, other criminal matters involving a completely different subject matter, and that is the insurrection. He presided over many cases involving defendants brought into court by the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia for the insurrection on January 6th. Now he is presiding over this case weeks long about whether or not Google violated our nation's antitrust laws. And he will make a decision, presumably sometime in the months ahead. Interesting case, interesting arguments. The government, of course, claims that Google competed unfairly when it paid Apple and some other companies billions of dollars to automatically handle searches on things like smartphones and web browsers. Google, on the other hand, insists, as it did during the course of the trial, during the course of oral argument here, that consumers use its search engines because it is the very best product that is out there. The trial, once again, as I indicated, the biggest challenge to date to the power of today's tech giants, which have defined, frankly, an era in our nation. Billions of people around the world depend on these products for information and for social interaction and commerce. American regulators have also sued Apple and Amazon and Meta in recent years for like monopolistic behaviors. Google's case is likely to set a legal precedent for that group. An awful lot of people looking at this and saying, this is the most important decision and the most important antitrust trial of the 21st century. At the heart of the case, again, is Google's dominance in online searches, which generates billions in profits, as we know, annually. The government, once again, the Justice Department, maintaining that Google's search engine conducts nearly 90% of all web searches. The company spent about $26.3 billion in 2021 alone to become the default search engine on browsers like Apple Safari, Firefox, And what that means, at least according to the government, is that it automatically selected for users out of the box those browsers and those search engines, and all of that, again, presented during the course of the trial. Apple's share, about $18 billion, according to an awful lot of reports. It's arguing, again, that those contracts were designed to defend its search business monopoly and hurt the ability of other companies like Microsoft and DuckDuckGo to compete in this area. Now, Judge Mehta, during the course of oral arguments, the closing arguments of recent days, has grilled both sides. And so not a lot of indication, unlike some of the Supreme Court cases that we've talked about, not a lot of indication coming out of Judge Mehta about how he is going to resolve this dispute between Google and its leadership and the leadership of the Department of Justice, the United States of America, trying to poke holes, frankly, in the closing arguments in this landmark monopoly case, questioning the government's argument that Google's dominance had hurt the quality of the experience for searching for information online. Ask them about that, the quality of the product. Didn't this, in fact, enhance in some ways the quality of the online experience, but also pushing back against Google and defending its central argument that it isn't a monopoly because, according to Google and its lawyers, Google uses other companies like Amazon to search for shopping items and TikTok to search for music clips. In other words, pointing directions in other areas. Certainly, I don't think that the average person, Judge Mehta said, would say that Google and Amazon are the same thing. And so Judge Mehta, looking at both sides and wondering aloud whether or not one side or another has the better of the argument. The judge questioned how it would be possible for another company to beat Google out as the search engine that automatically populates for Apple's web browser, Safari. He proposed, for example, that it could be impossible without having billions of dollars to spend to truly build a competitive search engine and billions more to pay Apple. He prodded Google's lead litigator on the argument that companies like Amazon and ESPN are two competitors at the same time to its search engine. He noted, for example, interesting that he wanted to know who the shortstop, that if he wanted to know who the shortstop for the Baltimore Orioles was in 1983, he would most likely use Google. And the point of all of that, this discussion between the judge, Judge Mehta, and the lawyers for the Justice Department and the lawyers for Google, is that he is testing the legitimacy, the strength, the power of the arguments in both sides, interrupting them about issues that he is identifying. Again, no jury here, no jury to decide this case. Judge Mehta will be determining whether or not the allegations of antitrust claims against Google held up. An awful lot of predictions that he is not going to find that Google has engaged in so much violative behavior that it needs to be broken up, but that would be one of the remedies. Unlikely he will do that. He may do some things short of that along the way, some determination about whether or not some things in Google's practices do require some remedial action, some intervention by the courts based upon the Justice Department's allegations. Are there things short of breaking it up? Should they pay some fines? Should they do some other things in terms of their future operation to address what may or may not in the end be antitrust violations? That will probably come out long after the Supreme Court cases in June are decided. Judge Mehta now has that so-called under advisement. He can make his determination whenever he would like. It is no small thing. Weeks and weeks of trial testimony, of evidence, of documents, of arguments along the way. He's got a lot before him, a lot on his docket. We will continue to monitor that and report back on what the judge says in this Google antitrust case here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Matinee on Air.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. Today we're talking credit scores. I mean, we all know we're supposed to have a good one, but what is a credit score? It's a number rating how likely you are to pay back a loan. Anytime you use credit, you know, like your credit card or a mortgage, the info about what you borrowed and when you paid it gets sent to three credit bureaus: TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian. They track every transaction and compile detailed financial information on every single American. I mean, a little creepy, am I right? And they rate you on a scale from 300 to 850. Over 670 is good, and over 800 is excellent. Then the bureaus sell your rating to anybody who's thinking about lending you money, and you get a better or a worse deal based on your score. Best way to keep that score up is pay your bills on time. This is Carrie Joy from Work Money. For more everyday money tips, check out workmoney.org or text MONEY to 88285. Take good care.
This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
This is Amicus Law Review. This is our final segment of our two-hour broadcast this weekend. Thank you once again for joining me and Calvin, my wonderful producer, for our broadcast this weekend. We are concluding in this, our last segment, by returning, yes, as promised, to that trial going on right now in the Manhattan courtroom, presided over by Judge Juan Merchan. This is a criminal case. It is a state criminal case, not a federal case, brought by the district attorney. His name is Alvin Bragg, alleging that Donald Trump, the singular defendant there, 34 counts of allegations of false statements, false representations, false documents when it came to paying off Stormy Daniels, Karen McDougal, and others for keeping quiet about previous alleged sexual liaisons, relationships before the 2016 election. And again, as I said at the outset of our broadcast this weekend, that's the premise of the presentation by the DA, which is that this is also an election interference case accomplished through the violation of New York law by failing to come forward with accurate reports, invoices, checks, register entries, all those kinds of things. Lots of things going on in this case. And again, we are entering into arguably the third trial. We've had 2 weeks of testimony, not every day. The judge is taking Wednesday off to permit the parties and him to do other things. He also has a docket going on. But we know that from just this past week, we have a number of additional witnesses being presented again as a part of the prosecution case. The prosecution has the obligation, as you know, of presenting evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to prove the allegations in this 34-count charge against Donald Trump. And it's only if they meet that burden beyond a reasonable doubt to the unanimous decision of the jury that's, yes, there in the courtroom there in Manhattan, if they meet that burden, only then, by unanimous verdict, can the defendant, Donald Trump, be found guilty of one or more of those counts. Plainly, there are appellate rights that could follow this as well, which we have also talked about in the New York system, like they are in the federal system. But this past week, again, we have gotten more testimony presented by what? By the prosecution as a part of this case. That includes direct testimony, questions asked by the prosecutor, and then also as a part of our system, cross-examination by the attorneys for Donald Trump. And they have pursued that. And that is the appropriate part of the process. They are there to test the legitimacy, the strength, if you will, the power of the government's case. And so we concluded the previous week with some testimony of, for example, Rona Graff, who was one of the so-called custodial document witnesses, one of the technical witnesses. She's a former executive assistant to Donald Trump. And she came in and she told a number of things about her relationship, obviously, with Donald Trump, and said that, yes, indeed, in the database that the Trump Organization has, at Donald Trump's encouragement, he has information, contact information about both Stormy Daniels and also Karen McDougal, the principal subjects of these payments to them, in some cases through the National Enquirer, in some cases, according to the allegations in the indictment, through Michael Cohen and Donald Trump. She came in and talked about that. And what does she do? She provides a little bit more information to establish this tie, this link, which the government is obliged to show, if it can do it at all, between Donald Trump and his operation and these particular women, she basically establishes that, yes, indeed, there plainly was communication between them, followed by this fellow named Gary Farrow, F-A-R-R-O. He's the financial loan manager for First Republic Bank. And he is also not a direct fact witness, but he comes in and talks about the ways in which he established a predicate loan of $130,000, a home equity loan, which was extended to Michael Cohen, who will be a future witness here, probably next week, maybe the following week or so. He comes in and talks once again. He provides the financial records, the documents, the transactional piece that will support, presumably, what Michael Cohen will say down the road based upon the transaction between Michael Cohen. He gets this home equity loan, $130,000, which he then turns over to Stormy Daniels to pay her off, to be quiet about this previous sexual liaison. So we get those witnesses who are adding more information to the overall story. Independently, any of those witnesses does not establish proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But collectively, as the witnesses go forward, they add more to the story. They add more. They hang more things on the overall story that was told by David Pecker, the first and principal witness up to this time. We also had the testimony just this past week of an attorney named Larry Davidson. If David Pecker talked about the dark side, if you will, of publishing, or at least publishing in the National Enquirer, catching and killing stories, saying things that are not true, publishing things or not publishing things based upon not the legitimate interest in journalism, but upon political motives, Larry Davidson comes in and he talks about how he has clients. And the purpose of his work on their behalf, clients, is to manage things like this. He is the attorney for both Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels. And he comes in and says, yes, he brokered what he called consideration, basically the agreement for their silence in exchange for those monetary payments. He is subject to a lot of cross-examination along the way, and that happens very, very clearly and emphatically. We have Douglas Dowse, who comes in, who provides some forensics for an exchange, an electronic exchange, a recorded conversation between Michael Cohen and Donald Trump about the Karen McDougal matter. All of that comes in. And then finally, just late this week, the testimony of Hope Hicks. And she comes in and provides more information about what was going on in the context of the Trump campaign 2016 after news of the Access Hollywood tape breaks. I'm going to talk in the future more about credibility of witnesses. I would offer here that Hope Hicks, both in terms of her demeanor and substance, not only provides more information about what was going on at the time, connections with Donald Trump, conversations with all of these players, but also does it in a very compelling way. The final comment I would make is also about something that happened outside of the jury this past week, and that is the judge admonishing the defense and the defendant in particular about his public statements that somehow this so-called gag order, a word that once again makes me bristle, this order that prohibits him from talking about or calling names to witnesses and jurors, somehow prevents Donald Trump from testifying in his own behalf. And yes, indeed, Judge Juan Merchan says in the courtroom late this past week, let me be very clear, and here's the civics lesson from him, and also as we close out on our broadcast, that nothing about the order imposed upon a defendant here in any case prevents a defendant, if he wants to do it, from testifying. That's the right. Nothing prevents the directions of the court from preventing the defendant from testifying. More about those civics lessons from the bench of Judge Juan Merchan, from other courtrooms across our nation, as our civic media broadcast here in Amicus, a Law Review, continues in the weeks ahead. Stay with us for those discussions. Join us for those discussions. Thank you for being with me this weekend. Have a great week, everybody.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we talk to retired Major General Randy Manner about Project 2025 and what that could mean to American democracy. Hour number two, cars versus deer. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop.
Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.